Good morning, brothers and sisters and young people. Good to hear you're alive out there. And well, it's lovely to be in Boston again. You can imagine when I said to the people at work I was off to Boston, what their response was. They said, have a good tea party. And I have to thank you for your sensitivity, because nobody but nobody has said to me, do you want a cup of tea? Indeed, the opportunity has been, the coffee is down at the table at the back, and I see on the programme it's the coffee break that features, which is very sensitive of you, and I much appreciate that. We're going to be looking, God willing, during the course of the four sessions, at the life of a man who was after God's own heart. And as such, you would think that that was mission impossible. We know that the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? We know what comes out of the heart of man. And yet, God had declared to Saul, when he rejected him, that he was to find a man who was after his own heart. And just for a moment to linger on that prospect. It is, isn't it, a new covenant calling that our hearts are to be transformed. It was what Jeremiah and Ezekiel had spoken about, that the stony heart of Israel's flesh would be removed, and in its place there would be a heart that was inclined Godward. Now, that in Hebrews chapter 10, remember, is spoken of as being the very key principle of the new covenant. And I suspect that what it means, although we're always trying to understand more about what those great things signify, I suspect that what it means is that the men and women who were called by God under the new covenant relationship would be people who wanted to worship God. Didn't do it out of fear or out of force, but who did it out of inclination. And we encounter such a man. Well, let's pick him up, if we may, in Antioch, in Pisidian Antioch, in Acts chapter 13. Because in 20 words there, the Apostle Paul portrays for us the man whom we are to consider, a man who was inclined Godward. He's reviewing there, you remember the position in Acts chapter 13 and there at verse 21, Paul is reviewing Israel's history, and we're cutting into the middle of his review, for he says, and afterward they desired a king, verse 21 of Acts 13, and God gave unto them Saul, the son of Kish, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, by the space of 40 years. And when he had removed him, he raised up unto them David to be their king, to whom also he gave testimony and said. Now here come the 20 words. And they're very tightly packed, these words. You'll find three Old Testament citations brought together in the way the Spirit does, when the compression of what the apostle was actually speaking about in the synagogue is here displayed. I have found David. That's Psalm 89 and verse 20. I have found David. So it turned out not to be mission impossible after all. God sought, God chose, God found a man who was the man he was after. And then, the son of Jesse. Now, I think that little phrase comes out of 2 Samuel 23 and verse 1, which is, when you think about it, a fascinating place for it to come from, but maybe we'll touch on that later on. I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after mine own heart, which shall fulfill all my will. And that, as it were, is a little explanation of what was inclined then, or what was caught or captured in that phrase, a man after mine own heart. In the end, then, this man, with all his failings, with all his blemishes, was going to accomplish what God wanted. And of course, the encouragement for us is that it was through those failures and despite those blemishes that God brought him to be a man who was inclined to do his will, who wanted to do his will. Of course, Saul must have wondered about it at the time when he was first told, and that's the 1 Samuel 13 reference. Let's go back and have a look at that, 1 Samuel chapter 13. Because Saul's time as king is coming to an end, and it's an interesting feature of David's life that time and again David is seen for what he is by contrast with those who work and walk alongside him. That is, you know, I suspect often our own experience too. You know how the scripture says that we must exhort one another daily, and so much the more as we see the day approaching. And yet sometimes the very hardest things that happen to us are things that happen in our very midst, things that happen from our brethren. Sometimes the exhortations that are given are the most powerful and strong exhortations because wrong things are done. Have you ever had the experience, as I have, of sometimes listening to an exhortation in a Bible study and thinking, that can't be right, and going home with much more determination to look the thing up and work it out for myself than if something had been given that I thought, you know, that seems all right, and never give it another thought? You see, sometimes it is the failures that people make that can be very powerful in stirring us in a certain direction. Of course, we don't want to make the failures, because that indicates, as in Saul's instance, that he was being discarded. He was just scaffolding, if you like, in the building of something better. But the failures themselves ought not to say, well, if it's good enough for him or her, perhaps it's good enough for me too. We ought to say, no, that can't be the right thing to do. And here was the instance then with Saul. Saul the black heart. Saul the estranged. 1 Samuel 13 and verse 14. But now thy kingdom shall not continue. The Lord hath sought him, a man after his own heart. And the Lord hath commanded him to be captain over his people, because thou hast not kept that which the Lord commanded thee. The Lord hath sought him. So you see, God was seeking. God is a spirit. They that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. For the Father seeketh such to worship him. There's the sense of God then seeking through all the available people, looking and sifting and sorting, as it were. Although, of course, with his wisdom he knows at once. But God seeking for people who are going to be inclined towards him. The Father seeketh such to worship him. And David at the same time seeking for God and ourselves, seeking to find out the things that are right, inclining our heart, yielding our wills, and there being then that meeting of minds, that marriage, that covenant affinity. So David was being called and summoned, and he was going to be a different man from Saul. And what was the essence of Saul's hang-ups and Saul's difficulties? Well, when you think about it, Saul was a man who was called by God, who was essentially an unspiritual man. Do you remember when Saul had gone out looking for his father's asses, and it became clear during that little encounter that he wasn't a man who was in touch with religious things? His servant said, oh, there's a seer in this place, we might go and ask him. And Saul said, what do you do about a seer? He didn't know anything about how to approach a seer, how to go about it. And Samuel, when they encountered Samuel, declared what was to happen to Saul. He gave him that little snippet of a prophetic profile. And it worked out exactly as Samuel had said. And when Saul encountered a band of prophets, he prophesied with them. And the record, 1 Samuel 10 it is, pauses to say that it became proverbial then. Is Saul also among the prophets? That's like saying, is Ross Perot a president? It has that sort of force of, it can't be right. But we were dealing, of course, there with prophetic things. Is Saul also among the prophets? Now, that was Saul's difficulty, that he was never on God's wavelength. He didn't even know that there was a wavelength button that you could turn in order to bring the thing in line with God. He always remained estranged. So the man whom God was seeking was a man who was going to be at one with him, a man who was going to be brought online with God. And again, you see how these things impact upon us. By nature, we're Sauls. We're naturally estranged. Is this looking Godward? Well, of course not. By nature, we're naturally estranged. But by our inclination, by the bending of our will, by our own seeking and God's seeking too, there comes to be that marriage of minds. And the intriguing thing that we need to think about in this first session is how God prepared the man, how he brought him, what the background was,
What brought them together? And what fashioned this man, who was naturally like us, into a man who became like God, who acquired divine instincts and divine attitudes? A man, for example, if you come for a moment to Psalm 18, let's just penetrate into the middle of David's experiences. Well, indeed towards the end of David's experiences, although it's Psalm 18. You can see there from the heading, Psalm of David, the servant of the Lord, who spake unto the Lord the words of this song, in the day that the Lord had delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul, and he said. And that's 2 Samuel 22. So you can tell the setting for this particular psalm. If you ever come across Fawcett's book, Studies in the 150 Psalms, it's sort of blunts undesigned coincidences related to the psalms, out of print now, although you sometimes see it reprinted. And he's fascinating in terms of the historical linkages, but this is done for you. You can tell that this is after the time of Absalom's rebellion. This is after the time of Shimei's cursing. This is after the time of the revolts that had happened, Sheba's revolts, and the problem with Saul's sons who had been hanged, and the Philistines and their conquests. You can tell that from the preceding passage in 2 Samuel 21. So 2 Samuel 22 is that sort of setting, when David's been through the mill and when he's come out. And look what it starts by saying, the Revised Version, I love thee, O Lord my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my strength, in whom I will trust, my buckler and the horn of my salvation and my high tower. I will call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised. So shall I be saved from mine enemies. And you see David there looking back now. He doesn't say, oh, it's been a hard struggle. Oh, dear me. I don't know what God's been thinking about in messing me around like this. I really don't think I deserve it. You see, here is the man now who has been brought through affliction into a oneness with God, who is able to say, I love thee, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress. And that's the very same word that later on features as the cave of Adullam, the place, the strong place, the fortress. That David, in all his wanderings, had found God as the refuge and the stronghold, and now rested his entire weight in him. Or come to Psalm 89, and notice now God reviewing his search for David. His search. When he looked through all the potential and possibility, and there at verse 19, a vision, maybe to Nathan, perhaps to David. Psalm 89 and verse 19, then thou spakest in vision to thy Holy One and saidst, I have laid help upon one that is mighty. I have exalted one chosen out of the people. So first there was the search, then there was the calling, then the choosing. I have found David, my servant. With my holy oil have I anointed him. That's a word in the Septuagint which is almost the same as the word for Christ. He was Christed. Well, we know why, don't we? Because it was the pattern of the greater Son, who also had to be sought for, and who would also incline his heart and his mind, whose nature would be crucified that the life of God might be manifest in him. With whom my hand shall be established, mine arm also shall strengthen him. The enemy shall not exact upon him, nor the son of wickedness afflict him, and I will beat down his foes before his face and plague them that hate him, but my faithfulness and my mercy shall be with him. So God was finding a man then who was purpose made, but not purpose born, purpose made. God was going to fashion and shape and develop this man in precisely the same way that he is about with each one of us. That he has called us from a variety of different circumstances, from lowly situations, we were nothing, the offscouring of the world. And God has drawn us too, and invites us to incline, to yield, to give, to fall. He chose David. Look at what Psalm 78 says. And remember the setting here. He chose David his servant and took him from the sheepfolds. From tending the ewes that had young, he brought him to be the shepherd of Jacob his people, of Israel his inheritance. With upright heart he tended them and guided them with skillful hand. And there's a detail there that tells us an enormous amount about the way in which God looks at us in the small things of life. You see, when you think about the psalmist now reviewing the great quest and challenge, there's a curiosity. Can you see it there in the words of Psalm 78? He chose David his servant and took him from the sheepfolds. Okay, this was a lad who was a shepherd then. But then the detail. From tending the ewes that had young, he brought him to be the shepherd of Jacob his people. Now, why ever does it say that? From tending the ewes that had young. If you've ever wandered around and looked at sheep, I'm not quite sure whether you're farming stock here or whether you're an urban group, but perhaps I ought to tell you that I was brought up in a village surrounded by sheep, and my sister now has a sheep farm which she and her daughter are looking after at the moment. And when you look at ewes that are great with child, with lamb, then of course a ewe is an absolutely helpless thing. And when it's got lambs, then of course it widens out and it waddles, and you've got to be very careful with a ewe, because if it falls over, it can be quite a bit of difficulty getting it back up again. And they're very prone to predators and to difficulty. And David then is characterized as being someone that God thought to be suitable as a shepherd for his people, because he was careful for the helpless and the needy. See, we tend to look at big things, don't we? We say to ourselves, what big thing shall I do for God so that I can impress him and show him that I'm the person he wants? And God was looking for the little things. He was looking, in this instance, for the people who were careful for the little ones, who were careful for those who were in need. In the same way that he looks at our ecclesias too, and he says, who is it who has a care for the children, for the youngsters, for the aged, for the infirm, for those who are in need? That was how David was being trained to be a king. Because God had him sitting out in the sheepfold with all the dangers and deprivations that were associated with that. He was looking after these poor, helpless old sheep, so that he could therefore become qualified to feed God's people, to tend the nation. And you can see that aspect through and through in David's life. He never lost the sense of it, the sense of care or concern. For example, when he was summoned to the battlefield, well, Jesse had sent him there and told him to go and take some food to his sons. The record carefully records in 1 Samuel 17 that he left the sheep with someone else. Or if you stretch right to the very end of David's experience, when the angel has his sword outdrawn over Jerusalem, and when it is about to fall in judgment, David says, but these sheep, what have they done? Well, of course, there wasn't a sheep to be seen, but they were the people, and David saw them still as though he were the shepherd of God's flock, because he had learned the lessons. And that's what ecclesial, and that's what family, and that's what work life is all about, isn't it? It is about the process of learning spiritual lessons that will see us through on our way. And God started with David in a way that he meant to go on. He appeared to overlook him. And as such, David, who perhaps knew nothing about the incident at all, must have wondered just what it was that God was doing with him. You remember the episode now, that the moment when the quest has come towards its climax, and God has sent Samuel to Jesse. Now that's a remarkable thing in itself. When we were reading it, weren't we, in 1 Samuel chapter 16, when the mission was begun, of all the places where God should be sending Samuel, well, it was to Bethlehem. Fill thine horn with oil, 1 Samuel 16 verse 1, and go, I will send thee to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided me a king among his sons. And There's a real curiosity when you think about it. Bethlehem was a nowhere town, wasn't it? Remember Micah says in chapter 5, Bethlehem, though that be the least of the cities of Judah, Bethlehem was a nowhere place, and Jesse was clearly a nowhere man. He was a working class farmer. You remember when he sends David off to Saul with what he could muster? He sends him with a bit of bread and cheese and a bit of wine. He doesn't really have very much, Jesse. Indeed, when Samuel comes to Bethlehem and says, I'm going to meet and have a sacrifice with Jesse, it was clear that Jesse was not among the elders of the city. He was a nobody person himself. And you can understand why. Those of us who've got children know full well why it was that he was steeped in poverty, because he had such a lot of children. That's why. And when it came to it, and Samuel was summoning Jesse and his sons, you will remember there that Jesse had a little bit of difficulty remembering quite who all his sons were. Well, he could remember Eliab, of course. Everybody remembered Eliab. He was a fine lad. And then he could recall, yes, after that there was Abinadab and there was Shammah. And so he catalogued all the ones that he could. And they all came to the sacrifice. And there they passed before Samuel. And you perceive something here of Samuel's situation in relation to our own condition. If we were choosing people to be kings and priests for God, well, we'd pick the big people, wouldn't we? We'd pick the obvious candidates. And when Eliab came by, he was clearly a strapping lad. He was the sort of lad you'd be pleased to have in your army, although in truth he wasn't what he looked. But when he came by, Samuel said, "Surely this is him. Surely," verse 6 of 1 Samuel 16, "the Lord's anointed is before him." But the Lord said unto Samuel, "Look not on his countenance, or on the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord seeth not as man seeth. For man looketh on the outward appearance, but the Lord looketh on the heart." And time and again in David's experience, you have that sort of situation. You have people. Take, for example, Eliab himself. When Eliab later on sees David come to the battlefield, look what he says. "With whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle." And Saul's in exactly the same situation. "You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, and he has been a man of war from his youth." You see, they're all doing the same thing. What Samuel had done, Eliab does, now Saul does, and it's a fatal mistake for Goliath. "When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and comely in appearance. And the Philistine said to David, 'Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?' And the Philistine cursed David by his gods." So we must be very careful not to slip into Philistine ways. It's easy for us when we're reviewing the possibilities, for example, in the ecclesia. What a multi-talented group we are by the grace of God. What abilities we have if we are prepared to yield them in God's service. It's easy for us, isn't it, to say, well, he or she is the obvious candidate. But the Lord looks at the heart. Come to that, it's easy for us to look at ourselves and to say, well, everything seems to be outwardly okay. I go to the meetings regularly. I do all the things that you would expect of a good Christadelphian. But in truth, if we would only penetrate by self-examination, we may well know that we're not right with God. The Lord looks upon the heart, remember. And God's ability to search and to penetrate and to pierce looks to the very core of our being. And he knows, in a way that we should strive to know too, whether or not we have really yielded ourselves and given our full wills. Well, Samuel was having difficulty, as we do, getting that into focus and perceiving what God really wanted. And as they went by, one after another, none of them were acceptable. And he said to Jesse, "Have you got any more?" And Jesse was clearly working his way through. And of course, he'd left David out in the fields, hadn't he? Now, isn't it a curious thing that in a nowhere town with a nobody family, there was a son who was so at the foot of the list that his father couldn't remember him? came across a little while back now when we were visiting Sierra Leone, a little tot of a kid who was walking along carrying a bucket of water. And I must say, I thought it was a fairly significant thing for a youngster to be doing. But when I inquired of the brother who was walking up the road with us why such a little child would be carrying such a big bucket of water, he said, "Oh, I was the youngest in our family too. I kept wishing my parents had had some more children." Because the task kept getting passed down. The younger was the servant of all. And that seems to have been David's situation too. There is another possibility, because I want you to notice that when in verse 12 Jesse sent and brought David in, the record says, "Now he was ruddy, and withal of a beautiful countenance, and goodly to look to. And the Lord said, Arise, anoint him, for this is he." It's an unusual thing, that, isn't it, for David to be described as of a beautiful countenance and goodly to look upon. Sometimes it's suggested that he had fair or auburn hair, that he was rather different from the usual swarthy, dark appearance that you'd associate with a Jew. And therefore the possibility exists that David, in fact, was step-son of Jesse. I must say I think it is more a possibility than a reality, but I'll show you the passage from which you could build a hypothesis if you want. It's 2 Samuel chapter 17, and a detail there associated with Amasa and Amasa's pedigree. 2 Samuel 17 and verse 25. "And Absalom made Amasa captain of the host instead of Joab, which Amasa was a man's son, whose name was Ithra, an Israelite, that went in to Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, sister to Zeruiah, Joab's mother." Now notice there that Abigail, who was David's sister, is here described as Abigail, the daughter of Nahash. Now, it is suggested, and this is only a suggestion, and you'll want to think about it a little bit. It is suggested, therefore, that Jesse had two wives, that he had married Nahash, and that later on he had married another woman, whose name is not given us, and that in this instance, what is being suggested is that Amasa was one step removed from Jesse's real family, as it were. Now, that doesn't actually impact at all on David's situation. David could well have been one of the family unit, and I'm inclined to think that to be the case. But you can, if you're so minded, extrapolate and move him across into the situation where really he was step-son. Still the son of Jesse, but born this time of an unknown mother, whose name was Nahash. Well, that may be the case. Nahash, it is sometimes suggested, was a woman. Apparently the name could be male or female. The Jews actually said that Nahash and Jesse were one and the same person. Or it may be that the very same mother had first of all given birth from another father and later had married Jesse. In other words, there are all sorts of possibilities in the pedigree. But it's the one possibility that gives rise to the prospect that David might have been born of a different situation and setting, and that therefore he might not be quite as swarthy and as typically Jewish. And perhaps, therefore, Jesse had regarded him as, well, a little bit apart. I'm not inclined to that view myself, but I mention it just in passing in case you wanted to think or pursue that forward. I think rather that back in 1 Samuel chapter 16, it was just that David was right at the foot of the pecking order. And as such, well, it was understandable that you would forget him, because there were such obvious prospects. There were such good, big, strapping lads that surely if Samuel was looking for someone there to anoint, well, he wouldn't look for a stripling, for a wimp like David. And anyway, he was doing a good job out in the field, so leave him there. But when the Lord said to Samuel, "This is him," a curious detail is there in the record. Then Samuel, verse 13 of 1 Samuel 16, "Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brethren." You see, for all the world, it looks as though then Samuel quietly anointed David, and the brethren thought nothing about it at all. Already consider now, Eliab said, well, who are you? Why aren't you looking after those few sheep in the wilderness? I know what's in your heart. Had he forgotten that David was anointed? You know, I suspect what it is that they had merely written this off as something religious. They'd said, well, funny old man, this Samuel. Nasty bit of work if you crossed him, I would say. What's he doing pouring oil on our brother's head? They had not given the import or significance to that act that in truth they ought to have done. You see, there is a sense, isn't there, in which our heads have been touched with oil. There is a sense in which God, who has sought for us, who has called us, who has chosen us, who has bidden us become kings and priests, there is a sense in which we have been touched by the anointing ourselves. There is a sense in which God, who has sought for us, who has called us, who has chosen us, who has bidden us become kings and priests, there is a sense in which we have been touched by the anointing ourselves. And as such, we are being called to be God's people, consecrated and set apart to be his servants. And David's life takes a marked change from this moment of his consecration. The anointing oil had touched him. He'd become, as it were, a prophet. He had, in fact, begun the path that would make him a priest. And he was also proceeding towards the time when he would be a king. Remember that incident when later on he would act as a priest? He would dispense bread and wine. He would offer sacrifices. He would enter into the very presence of the ark. All those things were here, tightly packed in prospect in that act. He was anointed with the oil of gladness in the midst of his brethren. And again, you can see the Messiah, can't you? The pattern of the Messiah coming through, and the prospect of what was to be one day. And the record says that the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. So Samuel rose up and went to Ramah. And now David's life would never be the same, but where was he to be found? Well, the intriguing thing was that David was then to be found back in the sheepfold, looking after the sheep. And it was as though God was playing a game of yo-yo with David. You know, he was sending him down, bringing him up, sending him down, bringing him up. And so David's experience was going to be like that for some time to come. David now back in the sheepfold, well, he was still looking after the Sunday school in our terms. You would have thought he'd have got onto the platform, but no, the arranging brethren had thought he should still carry on in the Sunday school. Oh, he was up to the youth circle, back to the Sunday school, up, down, and so David's experience was going on like that, because he was a man who was to be prepared mightily for a kingdom that was to come. And so he was being prepared. And it may be that at that time, David went to Samuel, perhaps to Ramah. Maybe he was instructed there, because somewhere or other he had to get his education, because clearly he became a man of letters and an educated man. But the record is silent as far as that is concerned, except that he had learned the harp and become cunning with it, and he had learned prowess as a warrior or a mighty man. Because as David increased, so Saul decreased. And in Saul's depression, his servants were desperate for a man who would be able to soothe and calm him. Let our Lord now command thy servants, they said in verse 16 of 1 Samuel 16. A man who is a cunning player on the harp shall come to pass when the evil spirit from God is upon thee, that he shall play with his hand, and thou shalt be well. And Saul said unto his servants, provide me now a man that can play well, and bring him to me. They answered one of the servants and said, behold, I have seen a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, that is cunning in playing, and a mighty valiant man, and a man of war, and prudent in matters, and a comely person. And the Lord is with him. Wherefore Saul sent messengers unto Jesse and said, send me David thy son, which is with the sheep. And that's when you see what Jesse was made of. Jesse took an ass laden with bread and a bottle of wine and a kid. No, it wasn't bread and cheese, it was bread and kid. And sent them by David his son unto Saul. And David came to Saul and stood before him, and he loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. Now, I don't think that means that he was made a member of the royal household, but that he was given an honorary job. So that whilst he was there in the court, he was given a sort of place in the pecking order. And as such, he became the king's armor bearer and was entitled, therefore, to come and go as he wanted whenever it came that it was necessary for him to come and play with a harp. And so the situation proceeds and the events come towards their grand climax. And you remember the circumstances associated with that climax. Here is a man prepared. God has been working now with David, and he's pulled him out of a nowhere town, out of Bethlehem. He's brought him from a working class background, just a little shepherd doing the work that God had called him to. He's the eighth son, so he belongs to a large household. He has anointed him. David has become a psalmist. Maybe this was the time when he was to write Psalm 23 or Psalm 19, when he was to look up and gaze and see the heavens in all its wonder and marvel then at not only God's display of power in the firmament, but also the marvel of the wonder of his word that David was learning. He had learned to be a protector. He had become a court musician, and he was also a shepherd in Bethlehem. You see, I think as part of the divine yo-yo that was proceeding, that David, in fact, was going back and fore, back and fore. Of course, it was a wonderful thing to be in the court at a time when you had a man like Saul, a depressive, who was on the downhill slope. This man who had such an insight into sheep, who knew how careful you had to be with sheep in their various stages, who knew what it was to take on predators and to fight them single-handedly, now saw a man who was himself slipping down into danger and recovering himself and slipping down again. And there was the study of man at its worst. There was the black heart that he was able to study. And then he would go back to the sheep and take stock, and then he would come to the court. And God was preparing then David to have an insight into the human condition that would be vital to him as it is vital to us. We get such a display these days, don't we, of the things that go wrong with human nature. We see it on our television screens, we hear it on our radios all the time. What we are really learning is what human nature is like, what the downhill path is like. How low can you go? That low? No, lower still. And so all the time we have that aspect of it. But we need to remember the unseen things as well. Those are the things that are seen. But we survive according to the things that are not seen. For those things are temporal, but the things that are not seen are eternal. And David was clearly learning to see the unseen as well as the seen. And suddenly the battle was drawn. And you remember that where the battle was taking place, it wasn't a million miles away from Bethlehem at all. It was in the valley of Elah. The Philistines were penetrating from the plain where they had settled, and they were there in the Elah Valley. They were due west of Bethlehem. And David, no doubt, had wandered across these mountain ranges with his sheep. And now all of a sudden, the enemy was to be found in the Elah Valley. And a very formidable foe it was, too. When 1 Samuel 17 gives us the record and the account of the Philistines who had brought themselves into battle array in the valley of Elah, we oughtn't to think for one minute that, well, these were just Philistines. We write them off today as people who have no appreciation of art and music, don't we? But that was far from the situation. They were a mighty military foe. They were the sea people, you might recall. And when David at last was to encounter the formidable foe, well, again, I suspect we see it in sort of children book terms. We think of the situation where a stripling of a lad, very difficult indeed to find a picture that really does justice to the actual interplay of forces that was taking place there. David was doubtless quite a youngster. You can tell that, can't you, from Saul's response. He says, what, you a slip of a kid? And when he puts his armor on David, it indicates that David was obviously not that high, but was a reasonable lad. But he didn't say, well, I can't even see over the top of this breastplate. That wasn't the problem. It was, I haven't proved this armour. Let me go as I am. So David, in all probability, was a reasonably sized lad, but he had not proved himself in battle, as men count proved. That's to say, he had never been skilled or trained in the art of weaponry. But Goliath, well, the record is very careful in 1 Samuel 17 to paint the nature of this man who was 9'6" high and such like, who was clearly a big man, and who was the very epitome of human flesh. He was a man who was brass or bronze all through. He was a man who was accoutred with everything that you might expect of him, probably with a javelin or maybe a scimitar slung across his brow, across his back. And he was a man who was, remember, protected in all but the very vulnerable spot where which God would seek out. And these people, the Philistines, who in fact had now come to encamp on the sea coast, the Gaza Strip and the Mediterranean seaboard as we now know it, they were people who had come from the Aegean situation. In all probability, they were the very people with whom the Trojan Wars had been fought and who had been displaced and who, coming by Egypt, where in fact there were indications on the sculptures there of the sort of people they were, had in fact been ousted by the Egyptians and were therefore forced to settle in somewhere where, well, they couldn't be easily routed, and they were to be a sore in Israel's side. They were to be the sort of Palestinian people, I suppose, of their day for quite some long time. Indeed, Palestine, of course, was named after the Philistines. So David was really encountering a very significant, a very substantial foe. And yet when he appeared on the scene, and I want you to notice what the record actually says about David's situation, when he appeared on the scene and when he listened and saw, what David saw was utterly different from what we might have seen. What would we have seen if we'd have looked? Feathered headdress, we would have said, wouldn't we? Look at that remarkable feathered headdress. Look at the size of the man. Look at the breadth of his shoulders. Look at the weaponry he's got there. Look at the man who goes before him, who's bearing a shield. Look at all the problems, all the formidable difficulties that are there. And David endured as seeing the invisible. He waxed valiant in faith. He put the armies to flight. That's how he's summed up, remember, in Hebrews chapter 11. He looked beyond and saw the forces of God arrayed. And as such, he saw that this was no problem, that these people would be delivered into his hands. Here was the faith of Joshua and Caleb manifest in a later day, and David therefore proceeded with such certainty and assurance. He didn't need the things that he hadn't tried and tested, but instead collecting the stones as he went, scooping up 5 smooth stones from the brook and running towards the Philistine, he went and he prevailed. And of course it's a pattern and a picture. It's the very pattern of human civilization in all its might, in all its bronze mass, being overthrown by the stone that comes guided by the Lord. It's Daniel 2, isn't it? As clear as day, we know that clearly enough. And down goes the enemy, and David prevails. And you remember the detail that now follows? That in fact, the very end of the Philistine finds David in an interesting situation. There's been that skirmish with words, and then suddenly verse 47 of 1 Samuel 17, all this assembly shall know that the Lord saveth not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. And so it was that unerringly the stone had gone and the man had fallen, but verse 50 says, there was no sword in the hand of David. So David ran and stood upon the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of the sheath thereof and slew him and cut off his head therewith. And when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. See, the very situation then, the very picture. I hope those donuts are well settled by now, because this is a fairly formidable photograph to be facing at 10 o'clock. But the very picture and pattern at the very end of this dramatic encounter is of David standing there with Goliath's head, which he has picked up. And you know that as 1 Samuel comes to its close, he is to be seen there standing before the king. And what has he got in his hand? Well, have you noticed the detail of what he's got in his hand? There it is in 1 Samuel chapter 17. And there at verse 57. As David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. So I hope you can capture in your mind's eye that here now is the king whom God has discarded and the king whom God has prepared. In all his experience, he never forgot, or so it would seem, that a man's head is easily severed from his trunk. And as such, that we ought to remember that God puts man in his place. And in the end, man's place is destruction. And it's true for all our civilization, with all its allurement and fascination, that in the end it is destined to fall flat. And in its place one will come who is triumphant, the Son of Man, before whom the enemy will fall. And when David comes to write about these very experiences in Psalm 8, and you can tell that Psalm 8 is a hymn that was written about the conqueror that fell between the camps, well, that's the very significance of Muth Labin, which is how the psalm is described. David says, "What is man and the son of man that thou visitest him?" Why, the very record has got almost the very echo of Psalm of 1 Samuel 17 in it. By the mouth of babes and infants, thou hast founded a bulwark because of thy foes to still the enemy and the avenger. In the end, then, Psalm 8 was looking to the time when a greater than David would encounter an enemy that had to be fought, and he too would triumph. Why, he would be the very stone that would fell the enemy's sin, and as such he would sever it head from trunk, and would at last be able to put all his enemies' heads under his feet. And so we see the pattern then of a man being prepared, of God carefully schooling and shaping a man who, like us, would come to incline himself to divine things, and who in the process would triumph and conquer. And those things should give us great courage then and certainty, that our God will surely prevail, and for each one of us, he too will give to us the victory.